Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Holger Dressler, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Patricia O'Brien, an associate professor at Australian National University in Canberra, about her recent book, Tautai, Samoa, World History and the Life of Taisi O.F. Nelson, published by University of Hawaii Press in 2017. In this first biography of Taisi O.F. Nelson, O'Brien chronicles the life of a man described as the arch-enemy of New Zealand and the British Empire. He was Samoa's richest man who used his wealth and unique international access to further the Samoan cause and was financially ruined in the process. In the aftermath of the First World War, Taisi embraced nonviolent resistance as a means to combat a colonial surge in the Pacific that gripped his country for nearly two decades. Taisi ran a global campaign of letter writing, petitions, and a newspaper to get his people's plight heard. For his efforts, he was imprisoned and exiled not once, but twice from his homeland of Samoa. Today, Taisi is remembered as one of the founding fathers of independent Samoa. Patricia O'Brien, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Holger. Nice to be here.
Patricia, I wonder if you could begin by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself.
Okay, well, I was born in Sydney in an inner city suburb called Darlinghurst in Sydney, and that's where I grew up on the Pacific Ocean, spending a lot of time there, a lot of time, you know, contemplating life on the Pacific. And I started when I went to university, I went to the University of Sydney. I began gravitating towards studying history, which was a subject I always loved at high school. And then, you know, as I sort of advanced as an undergraduate, I became, you know, really fascinated by, you know, the new movements in post-colonial history and also women's history. And I started researching histories of Indigenous women in Australia, southeastern Australia, and from there, I sort of realized that, you know, Australian history doesn't end at its coastline, but Australian history is something which is intimately tied into the Pacific Ocean. And so, after I finished my undergraduate work, I postgraduate work, I began, you know, really diving into Pacific history. And my first deep study was about colonial representations of Indigenous women in the Pacific. And I very much, you know, structured that study as these colonial representations being a mirror of colonial preoccupations. So I sort of looked at how these images were changed and altered to reflect the preoccupations of colonials. But also I was very interested in putting real women into this history. So going beyond stereotypes and archetypes, but real women who've shaped history in the Pacific. So Indigenous women. And so from that point on, I've really been very focused on Indigenous-centered histories in Australia, in the Pacific, and in the, you know, wider British Empire. And that's the kind of that's where I kind of was, you know, about 10 years ago, really, when I was studying the Australian League of Nations mandate in New Guinea. And I became increasingly interested in that period between the wars, between the First World War and the Second World War, which I'd really kind of glossed over in my earlier studies. But I really found in the 20th century, and particularly between the wars, and this whole sort of shifting of imperial ownership and, you know, the rise of Indigenous resistance movements and the rise of, you know, race theories and eugenics, that this was a really rich time to study. And this is how I sort of came to be looking at this period in history after World War One, where, as you said, there was this huge colonial surge in the Pacific.
Right. Thanks for the background, and that leads us right to the book. So I wanted to ask you really how you came to write this biography of Ta'isi, such a towering figure in Samoa, and indeed, as you argue, in world history as well. How did you get to Ta'isi O.F. Nelson?
Well, that is a very interesting story. And basically the context is that I had been awarded a fellowship, the J.D. Stout Fellowship, to Victoria University Wellington in 2012. And my remit was to study New Zealand's mandate of Samoa, because I'd already been looking at Australia's mandated League of Nations mandate in New Guinea. So I thought, well, why don't I do a study of New Zealand's mandate in Samoa, and, you know, compare and contrast. And it was all very kind of, you know, very vague, I suppose, you know, 10 years ago, what I wanted to do. But in 2012, it was 50 years since, it just happened to be 50 years since Samoa got its independence from New Zealand in 1962. So there was a whole lot of, celebrations marking this occasion, looking back, happening, which I wasn't, you know, necessarily sort of structuring my study around that. It just, these things just happened to coincide. And it was also the year after the big earthquake in Christchurch. And how that impacted me was that there was a whole lot of, reinforcing work going on buildings in Wellington. And the library, the National Library of New Zealand, was actually closed for reinforcement. So the library and the National Archives of New Zealand were both housed together when I got there, which meant that everything I kind of needed was all there, and all these experts were, librarians and archivists were around to kind of fast-track my discovery of Ta'isi. And so what basically happened was that one day I was looking in these files of New Zealand's League of Nations. There's a lot of files in the National Archives about Samoa and the League of Nations. And I was actually just looking for a reference because I was finishing up a publication on Australia and New Guinea, but I had this big fat file and I started going through it. And I kept coming across all these letters from New Zealand officials getting really exercised about this man called Mr. Nelson. And I kept seeing all these references to him and really heated language and, you know, really sort of, you know, colorful and, you know, that he was just this treacherous figure and that they wanted to do away with him. I mean, I don't mean like, you know, they wanted to sort of disempower him and, you know, cut him out of this power structure. And I mean, there was all kinds of things going on. And so I'm sitting there thinking, well, who is this Mr. Nelson? Because I'm looking, you know, this is, you know, New Zealand governing Samoa. And of course, Nelson is not a, you know, a traditional Samoa name. And so I asked a librarian, I said, look, I've just been reading these archives and there's this person called Mr. Nelson who keeps coming up. And she directed me to a set of microfilmed letters that the library had. But I wasn't able to look at these letters unless I got permission from the family. And the family, the head of the person, the contact person who was head of the family that I had to contact also happened to be the head of state of Samoa at the time, Tuiatua Tupua Tamasisi Efi. So I was like, well, how on earth am I going to, you know, make contact with this person, this extremely famous person in the Pacific? And, you know, me just being a lowly researcher, and how am I going to make contact with this person? Well, New Zealand being a very small place, I actually I bumped into a colleague from Victoria on the street, and I was telling her all about what I'd found, and she said, oh, well, you know that this other person who works with us is very close to the head of state, and this person, her name is Tamasailau Sauli Sauni, who now is at Auckland University, and I met her one night, and I was, you know, just telling her about everything that I'd found, and, you know, just how fascinating this person was, and all the, you know, just running with all these things that I'd seen, and, you know, and I couldn't understand. I mean, it was already very apparent to me how important this person was. And I kept thinking to myself, why have there been no books written about him, let alone like 3 books or 4 books? Why are there no books about this person? And there was also 3 experts in New Zealand history at Victoria. And I asked each of them, I said, have you heard of a person called Olaf Nelson, O.F. Nelson? And 2 of them had not heard of him. And 1 of them had, only one. So to sort of like, you know, end this story about how I came to sort of write this book, the night after I met Tamasailau and I was, you know, thinking about all these things, I kind of had this sort of moment in the middle of the night where I thought, I need to write a book, you know, do this, you know, look at this mandate question about New Zealand and its mandate. I need to write that up as a biography of this person, but I could only possibly contemplate doing that if the family was willing to, you know, have me do it. And I contacted Sailau the next day and I sort of said that much to her, and she emailed me straight back and said, I'm so glad you think that, because I've already contacted His Highness and he would like to meet you. And then and then within a couple of weeks, I was in Apia sitting at Taisi's desk and going through his papers that no one had ever used before. And that's sort of like how I came. I mean, it just opened up this incredible goldmine of history, and that's how that kind of started. So it's sort of like this. It's very much a story about being in the right place at the right time, and also, you know, the small world of New Zealand and how these connections, these incredible historical connections, are made just because I happen to bump into someone, you know, walking around the streets of Wellington. That happened several times with the book, actually, and big advances with the historical connections just by meeting people.
That's amazing. I think that's great to hear that some of the historical research is actually, you know, by accident sometimes. It's not always planned out. And text and context came together there, the archive, and then also the time and the people you ran into. That's amazing. Mm. Before we get into Nelson himself, Taisi himself, and want to learn more about him, of course, I wanted to ask you a more sort of methodological question before we jump in, about the choice of biography as a genre. Mm-hmm. You just started talking about that you thought maybe actually a biography is needed. There was no biography of this important figure in Samoan and Pacific history. So I wanted to, you know, ask you about that choice of biography and how you approach the balance between an individual life and the larger structural forces in which this individual was embedded. Biography in the United States, at least, is a quite popular history genre. This is kind of the best-selling genre of history writing of presidents and others. So how did you approach this particular genre of historical writing?
Oh, well, you know, it's always... I hadn't, you know, written a biography before, but as I mentioned, you know, my first big study, I did sort of have small biographies of women throughout the story. So, you know, there was those sort of like flesh and blood characters that I had in the first book, because I really believe that, you know, history comes alive when you only when you are talking about, you know, flesh and blood people, and you're not talking about, you know, big meta narratives and bird's eye views of history and so forth. But I feel like in order to make a life make sense, though, you do need to pan back and look at, you need to go back and look at the bigger context, and you need to keep having these sort of like, you know, I always think of it as like a camera panning in and panning out from people's lives. And with Taisi's story, I mean, it's very much one about, you know, a person, and it's about a family, it's about a village, it's about an island, it's about the Samoan Islands, and then it's about, you know, the Pacific, and then he has you know, strong European connections. Anyone who's studied colonial Samoa like yourself knows that there's so many European layers to Samoa's history from the 19th century. Right. And Taisi was a bit different from many of those layers, because his bloodlines came from Sweden, whereas a lot of his relatives and a lot of Samoans have, you know, German ancestral lines. So, you know, the story, you know, I don't know if it was. I don't know if I have the magic answer about how to, you know, balance the context, you know, and the life of a person and tell the story, because I always feel like I'm, you know, I always feel it's a bit of a struggle to to keep focused on the life, you know. But of course, the way you tell a story, the way you write a history, is always determined by the sources that you have available to you. I was just very fortunate to have enough material that I could have, tell a story and track someone's life, and very intimate detail about his life, which I find is, you know, they're my favorite parts of the book when I'm talking about his great love affairs, which is really, you know, the love he has for his daughters and the love he has for his country. But that part of the story would have been completely opaque if it wasn't for the assistance of the family, because, you know, they're the ones who are the keepers of that history. And the fact that they were able to share that with me and that they were very willing to share that with me, I think I made the book so much richer. If I didn't have access to those family stories, then I think the book would have been, you know, a much less deep and revealing history, and it would have been much more about, you know, a public figure and a political cause and basically whatever, documents I could find in the publicly accessible documents.
Right. Yeah, I asked about the biography because I think you do an excellent job of like keeping that balance between the life and the context, panning out in zooming in, as you said yourself. So let's talk about the subject of your biography, about this man, Olaf Frederick Nelson. Tell us a little bit about him. Who was he? Where was he born? When? And we'll start sort of with the childhood and then go from there.
Okay, well, he was born in 1883 in the village of Safune on the island of Savai'i in Samoa. And as I mentioned, his bloodlines were Swedish, his father through his paternal line. His father, August Nelson, came to Samoa at the time when a lot of the early European men were coming to Samoa, at the beginning of the plantation economy that was beginning in Samoa in the 1860s. He came in the 1860s, and one of the ways that these incoming men were able to establish themselves in Samoa was through marrying local women, and that is what August Nelson did. He married a highborn woman from the village of Safune, Singer No'o Masoi, whose family were very, very, very dominant family in Savai'i, in their village of Safune, but also in the village of Asau, which is where the Masoi family had their, you know, that was the sort of the center of the Masoi family. So Taisi was born in Safune in 1883, and he had a younger brother and he had three sisters, and he Safune was a very small little village. And his family moved to Apia when he was quite young so he could go to school. And he went to school at the Maris Brothers School in Apia. And he went to school. He was very good at school, but he only went to school till he was 13 years old. And that was something that really amazed me when I was reading his letters. I've read so much of his writings. And I was always, I couldn't believe it sort of dawned on me that he actually hadn't gone to university or something, because his writing was so beautiful and perfect every single time. But he'd only gone to school till he was 13 years old, and at which point he went to work for the big German plantation company, DHPG, that really dominated the economy, the plantation economy of Samoa at the time. And he was an apprentice there, started out as sort of, you know, right down the bottom of the ladder at DHPG, and then he worked there until he joined his family firm, and his father's company became August Nelson and Son and they began their own commercial enterprise that was sort of a multifaceted business enterprise in that had shipping very much shaped around the copper industry and also mercantilist shops scattered around the islands, and that's how he sort of began his adulthood, really, was sort of, working in the family business. And that involved traveling around the Pacific too, because they had outposts in Auckland and also in Sydney.
Right. So Ta'isi early on was already traveling in the region, and then he would go on to travel the world. Yes. Let's move into the interwar period, or the 1920s, where lots of stuff is happening. There's a Spanish flu and influenza epidemic that hits Western Samoa quite brutally, with over 8,000 Western Samoans succumbing to that pandemic. And then Ta'isi, sort of in his younger years, in his 30s, coming into his own, connecting with other political movements, and then the origins of the Samoan Mao. So can you tell us a little bit about what the connections were between Ta'isi and the Mao, and what else he was up to in this important decade?
Yes, well, Ta'isi was sort of... Yeah, as you said, his life was, as a lot of Samoan lives were, was, fundamentally changed by the influenza epidemic, which hit in November 1918. And Ta'isi lost several members of his own family. He lost his mother, he lost his younger brother, he lost a sister. He lost his son, his youngest son. His father had already passed away by this point. So Ta'isi, was running the company himself, the family company, which was which, because of the war, because of the First World War, and the methods of controlling Germans, the large numbers of Germans who, instantly became sort of enemy aliens in Samoa. A lot of them lost their, their economic stakes in Samoa, and that was sort of like the end of the, sudden end of the DHPG is sort of like dominating the economy of Samoa. And Ta'isi, because he wasn't German himself, because he was Swedish, he was able to take advantage of this this situation, where a whole lot of competitors were, because of their connections with Germany, were kind of moved out of the picture instantly. He was able to fill that void. And so he was able to rapidly expand his business during the war. And then after the war too, in the 1920s, he consolidated his father-in-law's business too. His father-in-law was an American, Harry Moores, and he also had a very substantial, a business not dissimilar to the Nelson business, and Taisi was able to absorb that as well. So by around 1923 or so, Taisi was, you know, a very singular figure in Samoa, because he was very wealthy. He was very urbane. He was he was a spokesperson for the Samoan people, and an interlocutor, if you like, between the New Zealand administration. And I should, you know, just to sort of backtrack a bit, that New Zealand took over German Samoa in 1914 as their first act of World War One. So New Zealand was occupying Samoa from as a military occupation in 1914. And then in 1921, with the advent of the League of Nations, when that sort of came into effect, Samoa officially became a League of Nations mandate. And this is when you have a number of things happening, and sort of like Taisi becoming a political figure, because you have the Mao movement. The first one really happens as a direct reaction to what was seen as New Zealand's gross incompetence in allowing the influenza epidemic to wipe out over a quarter of the population in a very short period of time. So the years of, you know, the end of 1918, 1919, and beyond that, Samoa was, you know, ravaged by this epidemic. And it also, unlike our current pandemic, the influenza epidemic killed a lot of children. It also killed their young parents. So there was this real, the loss of children, but also the loss of the young leaders, and also young working people, had a really drastic impact on society and the economy in Samoa. And so the first sort of really strong protest movement against New Zealand, the first Mao, really erupts in 1919, as sort of a direct result of the influenza epidemic and all its ramifications. And Taisi was a spokesperson for the Samoans to New Zealand at that point. He was, trying to work with New Zealand and sort of get them to do things that were to ameliorate what was a really sort of bad situation in Samoa. So there are a lot of the early letters that you find with Taisi writing to government officials and so on really date from that period. His political presence increased again in 1923 when he became one of three elected members of the only representative elected representative body in Samoa, the Legislative Council, which was basically allowing the European community in Samoa to have some kind of political voice. And then in that capacity, he again was trying to work with the New Zealand authorities, but then the administrator at the time, an ex-general from New Zealand, George Stafford Richardson, who came to be administrator in 1923. In 1926, when he was still administrator of Samoa, he began doing things that really began to enrage Samoan people, and that was essentially things that were about interfering intimately in the family and cultural workings of Samoa, and also he wanted to institute these really clear and unbroachable barriers between the European community and the indigenous Samoan community. And these were things which Ta'isi found profoundly offensive. He really bristled against the what he saw as the this administrator, you know, acting as a dictator in Samoa, and also this interference in the Fa'a Samoa, you know, the basic workings of Samoa. And that's when you have this sort of eruption in 1926 of the next Mao movement, which became a global fight, and one in which led to Ta'isi being exiled, as you mentioned before.
Right, so let's dive a little bit deeper into this complicated period in the sort of second half of the 1920s and into the 1930s. I wanted to ask you a little bit about Nelson's mixed race background that you mentioned earlier. You write later on in the book that New Zealand officials constantly blamed people of mixed race descent for political unrest in Samoa. Mm-hmm. I found that quite interesting. And you just mentioned that Nelson was kind of, bridging, negotiating, mediating between the European settler community and Samoans. But he, in some ways, belonged into both communities. So yeah. How did New Zealand officials sort of frame this increasing protest in Samoa? And what was Nelson's role in all of that?
Well, that's a big question. I'll try and I'll try and answer it in a concise way. But yeah, the thing about race, the issues about race and about picking a racial identity and basically sticking with it is something which Ta'isi had to grapple with all the time. This sort of he was, as you said, someone who wasn't someone who just saw himself as European. He saw himself as a Samoan with European, European connections. He was someone who, he really is an interesting study in someone who was, this is a time where there was incredible prejudices against people who are mixed race, not just in Samoa, but in all kinds of national settings. And, this was especially the case in my home country of Australia. There was a lot of prejudice against Indigenous people who had, mixed race parentage. This is all part of the eugenic mindset where, where they sort of, the doctrine was that if you had any kind of dilution of your Europeanness, that this sort of degraded you as a person. I mean, this is all the incredibly ugly racist ideas, which I wish I could say were all in our past, but I don't think that's a bit too optimistic. But anyway, the point is what Ta'isi had to constantly negotiate was this invitation, if you like, that he always had from New Zealand, that he basically abandoned the Samoan people, who he doesn't see as sort of separate from himself, because the Samoan people are his blood. They are his kin. You know, they're his mother's family. They're people who he, you know, that he cares for and he looks after as the head of the family. By 1923, he'd become a Matai. He'd got a Matai title from his mother's village of Asau. That was the Taisi title. And according to Samoan custom, once you are given a Matai title, that becomes, you know, the name that you are referred to. So that's why I call him Taisi, because that was his Matai title. So he was someone who you know, found the whole notion that he pick one of his identities over the other, he found that really abhorrent, and it was something that made him extremely angry. And this was, you know, it was always a bit of a mystery. Taisi was a Methodist. He was a very devout Methodist. But I kind of knew that he had a dispute with the Methodist clergy in Samoa. And I could never, I never could understand why. I knew there was, you know, a lot of animus. And it wasn't until I was reading the letters of the administrator who was in governing the New Zealand administrator before Richardson, the person I just mentioned who sparked the second Mao movement. But when I was reading his predecessor's letters, I came across a letter which, you know, sort of answered that question, because he was writing about how Taisi was just enraged because one of the Methodist ministers had basically told him that he had to, he sort of, you know, framed it like a horse race and said, you can't ride the brown horse and the white horse together. You have to pick a horse. You know, so this whole thing about race and horse races and picking a colored horse, you know, Taisi just found that just so, so abhorrent. And it just started this, you know, this sort of, you know, this really sort of fractious relationship that he had with the Methodist clergy, which sort of continued on, which is sort of interesting given that he was such a devout man. But he hated the small-mindedness of racists and the implications of what they were saying. And, you know, so these issues were extremely important, but not only for his own self-identity, but also for the way that New Zealand envisaged Samoa working as a colony of theirs. And that was that they would, you know, that they could separate out the different communities within Samoa, and that they were basically there, you know, they had this whole colonial mission for the indigenous Samoans, and that the European Samoans were not to interfere or to have any, you know, they had no rights to interfere with what was happening with their indigenous uplift agenda. But of course, human relations are far more complicated than racial theories, you know, could accommodate. You know, that the racial theories are dehumanizing and they reduce people. And that is something which is, you know, really at the core of this story, and why the protest movements in Samoa erupted and became as sort of fervent and as protracted as they did. And Taisi took on the role of someone who was going to, you know, be the leader of the Samoan people. And for that, he was severely punished. As you said, he was exiled for close to 10 years. And there was a whole lot of other sort of, you know, a part of that was to sort of ruin him financially and to humiliate him. And, you know, all of those things that they did, but he still persisted in trying to bring about justice for Samoans. And what justice meant in the 1920s and the 1930s was for democracy to be extended to Samoan people. Because Taisi, as I mentioned, he spent a lot of time in New Zealand, and he could see the way that Maori people had a stake in the national government of New Zealand. And he was like, well, why can't Samoans be treated the same way? And he never accepted any of the reducing dogma of the racist ideas which New Zealand was, you know, using as their way of governing Samoa. So that's sort of like where the real clash was happening with those ideas and their implications.
Yeah, I mean, Nelson was only one of many people of mixed race descent who led global struggles against colonialism and racism in the 20th century. And I think he's much understudied, you know, in this kind of global comparative perspective. Yeah. So I wanted to sort of ask you about the later years of his life in the 1930s, and he would pass away in 1944. You evaluate Taisi's life towards the end of the biography. You call him a modernizer who fought to expand democracy, as you just mentioned, with two notable blind spots. You also say that he wasn't such a big fighter for the rights of women and also of Chinese settlers mm-hmm. in Samoa. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to have you elaborate a little bit more on that. How would you evaluate Taisi's life? How does he fit into other anti-colonial, decolonial, and also anti-racist, pro-democratic struggles around the same time, say in the first half of the 20th century?
Oh, that's a big question. I don't know if I'm quite, you know, if I'm qualified to kind of, you know, speak to that with any kind of expertise, except to say that, you know, as I studied him and as he became better known during the years that I was writing about him, and as I, you know, became more apparent to me about his contemporaries and people who, were, you know, trying to win the same outcomes that Taisi was hoping to achieve in Samoa, that, you know, he was someone who really stood out in that whole pantheon of nationalist leaders and colonial resistors that were active in this period. And you know, there's people who've written, you know, much better comparative work than me. I mean, that wasn't really what I was working on, with, you know, putting him into that context of other individuals. But, you know, certainly he was looking at what other people were doing. He was writing about other people, trying to publicize that to Samoan people through his newspaper, the Samoan mm-hmm. Guardian, which was a very important part of the story too. Sorry, I can't remember the other part of your question now, Holger. Sorry.
I just wanted to know if you had any thoughts on how his sort of pro-democratic organizing for Samoan self-determination sort of compared, you know, in the Pacific, maybe globally, but also his blind spots on, you know, the inclusion of women in the political process, and also some sort of perpetuation of stereotypes of Chinese settlers and also mixed race Chinese people in Samoa and elsewhere.
So, so as far as women are concerned, you know, Taisi was someone who, the thing about women, it's a complicated question because, as I mentioned to you, he was the father of six daughters. Who he was incredibly devoted to, and the descendants who I, you know, all the family that I work with, they are all descendant from his daughters. So they were the grand, you know, the mothers and the grandmothers of the people that I worked very closely with. Some of them remembered Taisi when, you know, they were small children, but. You know, they were very small when he died in 1944, as you mentioned. So the thing about his, you know, his daughters and the way he thought about women was that he believed very much in women being educated. His daughters were. You know, went to schools in Sydney and New Zealand. His daughter, Malay Enafau, she became a lawyer and was one of the first women to graduate in law from Auckland University and to be admitted to the bar in New Zealand. So she's a real trailblazer in terms of her professional career. And so the thing is that there was this sort of disconnect between power in society, power in the family, and political power. And Taisi was... as I said, I always found it sort of, you know, I'd always wish that he was like a feminist and that he promoted, you know, the enfranchisement and political empowerment of women. But that was not something that he pushed. And, you know, I have, you know, to me it seems incongruous with his other stances about women having power in the community, in families, and pushing for his daughters to have professional careers if they wanted to. So I could never kind of reconcile that. And also, you know, I never found that he wrote anything about it. You know, it's just something which... you know, it wasn't anything that he kind of addressed directly. It was just something that he, you know, he was someone who wanted to break down all these barriers, but making politics a realm for Samoan women was not one of those things, and I can't really explain why, except that he. Because he didn't really address it directly. Now, as far as the Chinese are concerned, he did, you know, there was a lot of prejudice against Chinese at the time, and that was something that, you know, Taisi also absorbed this idea about Chinese, because the Chinese in Samoa... at the time when he was alive, that they had been brought in as indentured labourers, and there was very much a sense that they were not of the same, I guess, sort of like cultural, racial strata as Samoans and also Europeans. So that was something, again, which, you know, I wished that, you know, when you're studying someone and so intimately sort of involved with someone who is so enlightened in so many ways, it's like you wish that they were also enlightened in all ways, but he wasn't. And again, you know, he was someone who had human failings and he had short-sightedness. And I think in these two arenas about the Chinese and about women as being politically active, I think that that's two things where I think he really did have shortcomings.
A complicated human being, after all. Thank you so much for this overview of Taisi's life. We didn't really touch on all of the aspects. If you're interested in learning more, please read Patricia's book. I wanted to end with asking you about what else you're working on right now. You finished this book, came out a few years ago. What are you up to? What have you been up to since?
Okay, well, lately, I've been very much involved with writing about the Samoan constitutional crisis, which
That's right.
actually just ended last week. And it's been really watching what's been unfolding in Samoa this over the past few months. And actually starting from last year, there was a lot of echoes of the 1920s in what Samoa's been going through over the past year or so. And there's been so many things that very clear to anyone who knows the history about the 1920s. About the things that were happening now, and the rise of the political movement, and the constitutional crisis, that Samoa very recently has been taken almost to the brink of dictatorship. But these are all things that a lot of people could see very clearly were things that Samoa went through 100 years ago. So that's something I've been working on, and I've really enjoyed writing those pieces for The Conversation. The political crisis is, I've written a number of pieces as it sort of has dragged on and on and on since April. So I've been working on that, and I'm also editing a book on Samoan, the Samoan constitutional crisis, which we hope to get out next year, co-edited by Thomas Sailau, Sauli Sauni, which we hope to get out for the 60th anniversary of Samoan independence, which is next June. And that's bringing together a really interesting array of people to look at what's happening in Samoa now and, but very much with this historical perspective as well. And in addition to that, I'm also working on a biography of the Australian Hollywood star Errol Flynn, which has a whole lot of dimensions about colonialism, about whiteness, about racial stereotypes, about Hollywood culture, and it's a very rich story. But your question before, Holger, about how to balance the context and the life, that's what I'm grappling with on a daily basis, as I guess all biographers do. But yeah, there's a lot of big dimensions, but trying to sort of pare them back into a person's life is sort of the you know, the things that occupy a lot of my time and thoughts at the moment.
Great. These all sound like amazing projects. Patricia, I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it. Take care.
Thank you very much, Holger.